Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and this evening, the views of our special guest, Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin, who was with the Special Forces and fought in Vietnam, has some amazing stories to tell. But before we get to that, I just want to lay the background of what's going on today. Certainly, we have been involved fighting in Iraq for 47 months now, just about 47 months. Remember, we were able to defeat Germany in about 42 months during the time of the Second World War, but we've been in Iraq for 47 months, and things are far worse off than when we got there. At least they had a stable society, and they had food and water, and they didn't have people killing other people, and tens of thousands of hundreds of thousands of civilians were not being regularly killed. And we've been in Afghanistan for 5.5 years. We went to Afghanistan to catch the wicked Osama bin Laden. So, well, he escaped, so why are we still there? And there are a lot of unanswered questions. And, well, let's take us to Vietnam. I mean, we were in Vietnam for 10 years, the mightiest nation in the world, with the mightiest army in the world, the finest fighting men in the world, fought a 10-year battle against a little country the size of the state of Mississippi, and we lost the war. And we lost the war there because our soldiers were never allowed to win. In a similar matter, we're not being allowed to win in Afghanistan. We're not being allowed to win in Iraq. They've never given them adequate troops. We should have had 1 million men going in, but they never intended to win. They just went in to create a crisis so we could justify staying there and keeping our troops indefinitely in Iraq, as our troops are still in Hitler's in Germany 60 years after the war, and Japan 60 years after the war. Our troops are still stationed in South Korea 50 years after the war ended, and our troops are going to remain in Afghanistan and Iraq indefinitely, unless the American people understand that something's wrong, there's another agenda. The people who rule us have a different worldview than the average American. And with that as a background, Colonel Marvin, thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
It's a blessing always to be with you and the station that's willing to tell the truth to the American people.
Well, why don't you tell us about your tour there in Vietnam? Because I think it's so vitally important that they understand not only what you did, but what you were asked to do, and, of course, why they actually set out to kill you and your men. Why our own Central Intelligence Agency set out to kill you and your men.
Well, it's kind of a long and involved story, as you know, and y'all that are listening should know that Dr. Stan has my book, Expendable Elite, which has all the details not only about the time that I spent in Vietnam as the commander of a top-secret independent operation, but it also tells about the trial when our government, using the Special Forces Association, attempted to get my book off the market and get the truth about the CIA sending friendly forces to try to invade my camp and kill all my men, to include the Vietnamese that were in that camp.
And I think it's important that people understand that the CIA was intimately involved in everything going on in Vietnam, and is deeply involved in everything going on in Afghanistan and everything going on in Iraq today. So the same forces are there. The same Henry Kissinger that directed things in Vietnam is directing things over there in Iraq. And it's like deja vu all over again. Well, Colonel, you just go ahead and tell the story.
Okay. I went to Vietnam as a Green Beret. And when I reported to Colonel William Tuttle, who was the head of all the Green Berets in the 4th Tactical Zone of Vietnam, which was the Delta area from the Mekong River south, Colonel Tuttle asked me if I'd volunteer to take a top-secret operation, which would be to command an independent operation and be the very first forces to be able to take the war into Cambodia, into the enemy sanctuaries. He was very careful to explain to me that if I accepted it, and that we went into Cambodia, me and my men and the Vietnamese that would be working for me, that we would have no artillery support, no air support, and not even medical evacuation support if we got caught inside of Cambodia, inside the enemy safe havens, if you can imagine that. And when he said, when you leave this door, when you close that door, it'll be as if you never saw me. I will never, you know, admit to the fact that I asked you to take this command.
But I think people have to understand that the military wanted to win the war. They knew it was ridiculous to give the enemy sanctuary. So our military went over there. You're in a war. You go in to win it. You don't go in there to play politics. And so they were willing to order you to go in violation of the rules of engagement because they wanted to win the war.
Yes. The military did want to win the war, but they weren't allowed to.
Right.
And I think I flew over a camp called Vinja, which was a special forces camp similar to mine, only it didn't have the authorization to shoot back at the enemy. And the captain that commanded the Green Beret team in that camp, he got shelled from Cambodia, from the enemy inside Cambodia, killed 5 of his people, injured a bunch of others, and he fired back into Cambodia at the enemy to try and silence their mortars. He was court-martialed and is probably still in Leavenworth Prison because he fired back at the enemy, which was against the orders from General Westmoreland and on down from General Westmoreland through Special Forces, as directed by somebody in Washington, D.C., primarily President Johnson and Henry Kissinger.
And so the Robert McNamara, a gruesome threesome, who were willing to send our boys over to die, but never to win. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin, and he was simply saying that he was, when he first arrived over there, he was a captain in the Special Forces, had a contingent, and they were going to be certainly working with the Hmong people along the Cambodian border. He was told by his commanding officer that he would have permission to go into Cambodia in violation of the rules of engagement, in violation of the orders from Washington, D.C. But if he was caught in there, why the commanding officer would deny he ever gave the order, because, of course, we'd been told we could not go into Cambodia, but certainly Colonel Marvin was given permission by his superior officer to do that because, you see, our military wanted to win the war. It was simply the people in Washington, D.C. who didn't want to win the war, and so every once in a while something would happen that they would violate the rules of engagement to try to beat the enemy, which our leaders never intended to defeat. So pick up the story there, Colonel.
It was such a shame, really. And one of the things that Colonel Tuttle said in that office before I left to go and take over the command of the independent operation, one of the things he said was that if you're caught inside Cambodia, you will be dropped from the rolls as a deserter. Now, isn't it something that an American soldier would go against the enemy to kill the enemy who's been killing not only our men, but the people that were there to protect? And if you were caught inside of their safe havens, which they shouldn't have had, then you'd be dropped as a deserter. And if you came back over, you'd be court-martialed for going into an area where the enemy was. And, well, so we, on the first day of January 1966 is when I ordered the first rounds fired from our mortars and rocket launchers into Cambodia, into the Viet Cong safe havens. So what we did was gradually over a period of about a week, firing every night at different times in the different areas in their sanctuaries, we caused them to move back about 3 kilometers from the border so that we'd at least have time to react to what they would try to have, a sneak attack from that side. But 3 kilometers is a little ways to move, and you don't dare, they wouldn't dare move at night because anything moved at night got killed. So that's what we did. And in June of 1966, a CIA agent came to my camp and asked me if I would accept the mission to send some of my Vietnamese Buddhist Wahaos into Cambodia and assassinate Cambodian Crown Prince Sihanouk. Now, I accepted the mission. I mean, Prince Sihanouk in those days certainly wasn't a friend of mine. I thought it was him who was harboring the Viet Cong. I didn't think it was our own White House that was giving him the safe havens. So I accepted the mission, but I gave him a quid pro quo. Now, the CIA agent's name was Walter McKim. It's in my book. And I gave him a quid pro quo in that I said that President Johnson would have to tell the American people that the enemy would be allowed no more sanctuaries inside of Cambodia. They even were allowed to use the Mekong River as their primary source of resupply of weapons and ammunition, and we guarded the ships going up that river, taking weapons and ammunition that then went to their safe havens, and then they come back and kill our people with those same weapons that we guarded so they could get them. Excuse me. Well, we prepared. I had, out of my forces that I had 100 and some volunteers. We needed 42 men to accomplish a suicide mission like Major Foy Van Lee, and I thought it would work best. And about 2 days before we were going to actually send those men into Cambodia to assassinate the prince on his way to a temple that he went to every year, the CIA agent, Walter McKim, came back to my camp, and I asked him what happened to my demand. I didn't ask the president. I demanded that the president, if he wanted us to kill Prince Sihanouk, he'd have to take the enemy's sanctuaries away from him. He wouldn't even respond to me about it. So I kicked him out of my camp and canceled the mission. I unilaterally aborted that mission. Sent him out of my camp, and when Lieutenant Strait, who was my exo, was started to walk him towards his little white CIA helicopter called Air America helicopter, he turned to me and he said, the CIA agent turned to me and he said, you can't do this to the company captain because you can't win, the company being the CIA. Well, 6 days later, I learned what he was talking about. Because my agents reported that an entire regiment, over 1,000 of the ARVN forces, the regular Army of Vietnam forces, with their American advisors, had been ordered to attack my camp and to kill us all. And that's when we put our area completely off limits to any forces of any kind. And then my team was ordered out. Me and my men all decided to stay with the Buddhist Wahaos. That was our mission, to stay there, and we knew why that regiment was on the way. And to be very honest, I assumed that if we would have left the Wahaos and headed in for the B team like we were ordered, we would have been ambushed and killed on the Baysack River. General Quang Van Dang, after being approached by the head of the Wahao Central Committee, is a gentleman who, with his senior American advisor...
Now, he was a Vietnamese general who was certainly one of the commanders of the Vietnamese forces in that region.
He commanded all of the Vietnamese forces in the 4th Tactical Zone. So this was regiment had been taken from him by order of Premier Key for the CIA. Premier Key and the CIA got along very well together. when as soon as General Dang got that word from the Buddhist Wahao chairman, he called Premier Key and told him that he was taking over the situation. He was not going to have brother killing brother. And then he flew with Colonel Desabree, who was his senior American advisor, in Colonel Desabree's helicopter over the Arvin Regiment, as it was about 10 minutes from my camp, and asked the American advisors on the ground, Colonel Desabree did, why they were going to attack An Phu. And he told them that there was a renegade captain named Marvin who was leading the Wahaos against the central government. That's the lie they told those American advisors.
Of course, they had to tell them a lie to get them to kill Americans, but they always do that sort of thing. Oh, it's always done, you know, in the name of national security, or they're the enemy. So that's why you have to kill them.
That's what I was trained to do as a Green Beret. They used in our training at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, in the spring of 1964. I was trained to be an assassin, a terrorist, and an industrial saboteur, as was needed by our government. And we were told, flat out, by CIA instructors in the spring of 1964, that we would be used outside of the United States to do those kind of missions, and the mafia would be used inside the United States.
Well, anyway, of course, the attack on your unit was aborted, and then you were able later to withdraw and still, of course, maintain your position with the military. Is that right?
That is correct. General Dang ordered the regiment back to its base. Colonel Brewer, my senior in the neck in the B team, who was actually supposed to be my commander, tried to court-martial me for not taking my team out of the area and for standing ground against that Arvin regiment, but the CIA wouldn't let them do that because I was on an independent operation, top-secret operation.
All right, because when you were there, you had an opportunity to see how they were actually, the American forces were allowed to allow the ships to go up the Mekong River, knowing full well that they were loaded with weapons that were going to be used to kill our boys. And yet, you were not allowed, the commanding officer in that on the Mekong River was not allowed to stop the ships that were carrying the weapons that were going to kill our boys. Is that right?
That's right. It was Captain James Miles commanded the A-team that was responsible for the control of shipping going back and forth into Cambodia. They stopped the as a specific example, and Jim Miles told me this personally. They stopped a Lithuanian ship in June of 1966, I think. No, excuse me, it was earlier than that. Early in the spring of 1966. And he was allowed to send two Green Berets, Americans, and two national policemen onto the ship and look at the manifest of the cargo. If the cargo manifest did not say war goods, they could not stop the ship and inspect it.
And because why would they say war goods? They would know which the ship would be stopped.
Well, specific ship, the manifest for cargo said 10,000 tons of toys.
And why would anybody send 10,000 tons of toys into a war zone?
So, anyway, Captain Miles knew that was a lie. So he sent two Green Berets and a group of, a platoon of CIDG, the civilian irregulars, up the Mekong River and watched them unload 10,000 tons of weapons and ammunition inside the VC safe havens in Cambodia.
And what people don't in America don't understand is that all during the Vietnam War, the United States government and Western banks were lending massive amounts of money or giving massive amounts of money or transferring massive amounts of money to the Russians, who are providing the weapons and the technology and the planes and the anti-aircraft batteries for the North Vietnamese that were being used to kill our boys in South Vietnam. Go ahead, Colonel. And certainly, you know, it must have been very disheartening for you and the other officers over there. In fact, didn't General Westmoreland ultimately write about this and admit this in his book, Soldier Reports?
Yes, and that book was published in 1976. And I've brought that to attention over the years, since 1988, to every single major media that there is in the United States that I know of, including Associated Press and all of them. And it's only people like you and Christian stations that have actually allowed me to come on and tell them the truth about what General Westmoreland himself reported in his book. And I put General Westmoreland in while he was still alive for a general court-martial. And it wasn't until after he was dead and almost 6 or 8 months later that I received an official letter from the Judge Advocate General of the United States Army in response to my demand for an investigation of General Westmoreland and also Colonel Tuttle for aiding the enemy. And they said that they could not be court-martialed because they were following orders from civilian or military authority above them.
And that's really true. They were following orders. And certainly the people in Washington, D.C. had no intention of winning the war.
That's
we never
right.
went there to win the war. That is what the American people never understood at that time, and that's what the American people don't understand today.
And I went back to them, as I believe I told you, Dr. Stan, and I asked them to identify those individuals who had given our generals orders to aid the enemy, and probably 80% of those 58,000 of our men and about 2 million Vietnamese that were killed, about 80% of them were due to the aiding of the enemy by our own government and the forced aiding by our soldiers on the ground. I mean, that's sad. So I also asked for a copy of the general orders, if there were general orders that specifically said that they had to leave the enemy and have sanctuaries in Cambodia. And by the way, I brought all this up at the trial, too, to the jury that acquitted us, my publisher and myself, and proved that that book that I wrote, Expendable Elite, is true, 100%. And I never got an answer on that, so I called the colonel that worked in the full colonel, worked in the, and still does, in the office of the Judge Advocate General, and I tried to get her to tell me what it is that I'd have to do from their office to get from their office a true and accurate answer to my query about who ordered General Westmoreland to give the enemy aid. And she said, I really can't talk to you anymore on this, and she hung up on me.
Well, you know, we have actually the rules of engagement. Senator Goldwater got those, and we make that available through Radio Liberty. If you're ever interested, we'll get you a set. He published it in the Congressional Record. The rules of engagement said that we could not attack their planes on the ground. We couldn't go into the enemy territory. We couldn't bomb into the major targets. We couldn't block the harbor at Haiphong. We couldn't sink ships in the harbor at Haiphong. We couldn't bomb the rail yards. We couldn't bomb the dikes. We couldn't bomb the power plants. We could not win the war. That's what an injustice was. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Colonel Daniel Marvin. We were just talking about, during the break, the fact that Colonel Marvin, of course, was totally frustrated, as I'm sure many of our men were, the fact that the military was not allowed to win the war. And I commented that we actually have the copies of the rules of engagement that were given to the superior to the military commanders. Senator Goldwater got them and published them in the Congressional Record. The American military was not allowed to hit any of the major targets in North Vietnam. They were allowed at times to bomb Hanoi, but only for very, very short periods of time. And then whenever they began to get effective, they had to suspend their bombing. They weren't allowed to bomb the port of Haiphong. They weren't allowed to mine the harbor in Haiphong. They weren't allowed to block the mouth to the harbor, as the French had done during their war with the North Vietnamese. They weren't allowed to bomb the power plants. They weren't allowed to bomb the dikes. They weren't allowed to bomb the Ho Chi Minh Trail. They weren't allowed to attack big fighter planes that were sitting on the airfields undefended in North Vietnam. The only time they could fire at those planes is if they were up in the air firing at them. They couldn't fire at the radar placements. They couldn't do anything about the supplies going up the Mekong River. Of course, the reason that this is true is because the Russians were financing the North Vietnamese, who were financing the Viet Cong, who were killing our boys. It was a make-believe war, but they couldn't let the American people know that. They certainly couldn't let the soldiers know that.
I'd like to pick up on that make-believe, Dr. Stan. When I left An Phu, it was the most secure area in all of Vietnam. And this was in August the 1st of 1966. And I went from there to a place called Triton, another Special Forces camp. The commander had been killed and they no longer had a commander, and I went in. They were Cambodian forces in that camp. And the first day I got there, the team sergeant said, "We've got a B-52 raid coming in today." And I said, "Oh, what is the intelligence that for why you asked for a B-52 raid?" I didn't allow them in my area because they just killed everybody in such a big area. And they didn't separate friendly from enemy. So he said, "Well, they just come in because they've got to unload their bombs."
They've got to unload their bombs. Right. And that's really what it's all about. It was all a make-believe war.
Yeah. He said they come into the Seven Mountains area, and he says, and he was upset, this team sergeant, because he said, "Then we've got to go within hours of them dropping those bombs and do an assessment of the damage and, you know, enemy killed in action and all that." And he said, "We send a company of irregulars in there and two Green Berets, and we have at least two people killed by snipers going into the area, and we have never yet found anything destroyed or any enemy dead or anything in the area, and yet we'll get a report." And 2 days later, we got a report from this B-52 raid that was that day, and they claimed something like 200 VC killed in action, a complete underground hospital complex destroyed, and they did absolutely nothing except drop their bombs.
Well, I had a friend who flew F-4 jets there, and they would take off in the morning, the squadron, three planes, each carrying a third of a load of bombs, and they would fly up to North Vietnam, and they'd bomb a bridge or something. And then they'd fly back. Now, one plane carrying a full load of bombs could have done it, and the bridge that they took out really was of no consequence anyway, because it was rebuilt the following day. Why send three planes each with a third of a load of bombs? Because it was all showbiz.
That's right.
Didn't a lot of the military eventually begin to realize that this wasn't a real war at all? It was never a war we went to win.
You know, sir, there's in the back of my book, Expendable Elite, it gives a some dialogue in there about meetings that they had between our government and the Vietnamese government, and all the lies that were told the Vietnamese government by our leadership. And I believe that I sent you a copy of a very recent email that I received from Tom Polgar, who was the head of all CIA activities in Vietnam, but who was unfortunately out of the web on a lot of the mean things, bad things, lying things that were done. Now I'll get back after the break.
All right, fine. Well, I think what the American people have to understand is you've never been told the truth about what really happened in Vietnam, how it was during the Vietnamese War that the American government was transferring equipment to the Gorky plant in Russia used to build the trucks that were then used by the Viet Cong to carry the supplies down the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Right.
And, of course, it was during that period of time that we supplied the money to build the Fiat motor plant there, and then the Kama River truck plant, the largest truck plant anywhere in the world, with American money during the war. Well, this is Dr. Stanback here. Our guest, of course, is Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin. And we're talking about his experiences in Vietnam. There was a movie that came out after Vietnam. It was called Apocalypse Now. And it starred Marlon Brando, who was supposedly a renegade officer who was, doing all these terrible things. And there were a couple of people who were sent in to kill him. But that was really a takeoff on a true story, wasn't it, of a courageous Green Beret captain who was really trying to win the war over there? What's that story about?
Well, I knew one of the sergeants that was down there with a team that, like we were working with the Buddhist Wahaos, they were working in the Cao Mau Peninsula of Vietnam, the farthest south area in Vietnam, with a Catholic priest named Father Hoa. And they trained Catholics as civilian irregular defense group fighters, and they actually did an outstanding job. They cleared the entire Cao Mau Peninsula of Viet Cong, just like we cleared all of them that were in An Phu when I got there. We cleared them all out and then back 3 kilometers from the border. And they did such a good job. I think that's what it amounts to. They were doing so good in winning the war that the team, the Special Forces team, like mine, was ordered out of the camp and ordered to just leave the Catholic irregulars on their own, just like we would have had to leave the Wahaos on their own. That would mean they'd have no more money, no more ammunition, no nothing. And his team, the captain that was down there, his team left as they were ordered to, where mine stayed. And then they sent 2 Green Berets in, and they killed him.
And that was why? Because he disobeyed a direct order.
That's right. And it was an illegal order. You know, the attorneys for Special Forces in the courtroom in January of this year kept on trying to convince the jury that I was disobeying orders, and all I would have to do is just look at the jury and tell them I did not have to obey illegal orders. And all of these orders that they claim that I disobeyed were illegal orders, and I will always disobey illegal orders.
Well, that's another story for another evening, and I would like to hear the audience here hear the story of what happened during that trial, where, of course, they set out to destroy you because you told the truth, and nobody, of course, is ever to know the real truth.
That's right.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin, and a very courageous soldier who fought valiantly in Vietnam, and but, of course, there's so much more to his story. Now, first of all, he has written a book called The Expendable Elite. It's been updated, and we carry the book through our ministry. But you've got a website. Why don't you tell our listeners about the website that you have and the information they can get there?
Yes, it's really a great website if you want to know the truth about what went on in our area of Vietnam and how that affected the whole war, and that's expendableelite.com. That's one word, expendableelite.com. And on there you can actually read parts of the book that are on there. It tells there's copies of all the articles many of the articles that were written after our victory in court in Charleston, South Carolina. All kinds of information about all different things that I was personally involved in, and including the stopping of an illegal movement of weapons from Thailand, to the United States that were a part of the whole U.S. program to assassinate Martin Luther King Jr. By the way, I've got that email in front of me from Thomas Polgar, who was the head of all CIA activities in Vietnam till the end of the war. In fact, he's the one that personally saw to it that General Dang was able to get out of Vietnam. And he said this, on page 322, you refer to the April 1973 meeting of President Nixon with President Thieu in San Clemente, California. They met several times during Thieu's visit. I was present at one of those meetings. I remember distinctly the promises President Nixon gave in the presence of Secretary of State William Rogers, the incoming Ambassador Graham Martin, and others, the betrayal of South Vietnam was the bitterest and most traumatic experiences of my life. It should be noted that the Americans working in Vietnam, including Ambassador Martin and myself, were betrayed too. We were never advised that the policy of supporting South Vietnam has changed.
Well, of course, it's a tragic situation that we betrayed those people, but of course we betrayed our own boys. The Gulf of Tonkin incident did not occur. 58,000 American boys died, 1 million South Vietnamese, 2 million North Vietnamese, but it's really succeeded, in my estimation, doing exactly what they intended. And those of you who heard me speak on this before, as I refer people to the January 1967 issue of Foreign Affairs magazine, that's what the elite read, the people who really run the country. The article was written by McGeorge Bundy, Skull and Bone Society, Council on Foreign Relations, National Security Advisor, the man who instrumental in getting us involved there, who betrayed, of course, Kennedy, who betrayed the American people. But he writes in January of 1967 about this idea it's either guns or butter, and he said that's really ridiculous. I mean, any true liberal should never accept the idea that we have a choice between guns and butter, because exactly the opposite is the case. Any true liberal who believes in the cause of rebuilding America and certainly going ahead and bringing in our socialist programs, and I'm paraphrasing what he said, and the true cause of health and education and welfare and rebuilding our cities, should never say we ought to get out of Vietnam, for exactly the opposite is the case. The road forward at home is by persistence in Vietnam. If we were to pull out of Vietnam, there'd be a tremendous reaction to our policies here. And as everybody was really saying, is this is a wonderful diversion. A wonderful diversion. If we were to get out, why, people have been objecting to the Great Society programs, health and education and welfare. Of bringing socialism to America. So that's what it was about. It was a diversion, and that's exactly what's going on in the Middle East today. It's a wonderful diversion, and as our boys go overseas to fight and die, we're losing our freedom here at home. Right. Go ahead, Colonel.
It sure would be interesting. Excuse me for interrupting. I get all excited when I'm on your program.
You go right ahead.
It would be interesting to know how many of those ships that carried weapons and ammunition to the Viet Cong came back down that river carrying drugs for the CIA to use in their distribution program throughout the so-called friendly nations.
Because most Americans don't know that the CIA was involved with the drug smuggling in Vietnam, just as they're involved with the drug smuggling in Afghanistan, and that's why we can never do anything about those poppy fields in Afghanistan. We could burn the poppy fields. We could spray the poppy fields. We could cut down the crops. We don't do it because the CIA wants the money.
And you know that the CIA and the mafia are just involved in just about every country in the world. And it was two teams of Green Berets, and I knew one of them, who went in and helped Castro and trained all of his people that then went against Batista. And that's how Castro actually took over that government. And as far as I'm concerned, the only reason that Castro is still in power is because we put him in power.
You're absolutely right, Colonel. But the American people can't believe that. After all, everybody, every intelligent, literate person knows Castro is the enemy. And then I always ask him, if he's really the enemy, why did President Clinton and John Rufino send a 125-man, heavily armed SWAT team to Miami, Florida, to kidnap Elian Gonzalez from his unarmed relatives and then send Elian back to Cuba to build up Fidel Castro's prestige, not only in Cuba but throughout the world, and give the Cuban people the idea of hopelessness? Why, if he was the enemy, why would they have done something so foolish? And, of course, it wasn't foolish at all. They wanted, of course, to build up Fidel Castro, to give the people of Cuba a feeling of hopelessness. They knew exactly what they were doing. They just don't want the American people to know. But that's another story for another night. Well, let's get, you know, a little bit perhaps into the background of what happened when you were in the assassin school. You were being trained as an assassin. You know, as part of your training, you volunteered for this as part of your special forces training. And what did the CIA tell you about the assassination of President Kennedy?
We had two CIA instructors, and it's kind of interesting because I was able to play a tape for the jury during my trial that had General William Yarborough's voice on the other end of it, where he admitted that they had CIA advisors, he called them, in the Special Warfare Center school, and that they taught assassination training, only it was called counter-assassination training. And in the book that you also carry, I believe, Without Smoking Gun?
Right, we do.
In there is the actual fact from Colonel Bo Greitz that he was an instructor as a captain in Special Forces the same time that I was going through that school, only he was teaching enlisted personnel, sergeants, the methods of assassination and terrorism in the same school. And they told us that they showed us exactly what happened in the Kennedy assassination, include advising us that there was a total of four shooters involved. Two of them were from the American Mafia. The other two were from the Corsican Mafia. One of the men on the from the American Mafia was on behind the fence on the grassy knoll. He's the one. His name is Jimmy Files. He's in Joliet Prison as we speak. He's the one that actually killed President Kennedy with a shot through the forehead. And the other one of the American Mafia was on top of the rooftop along with the FBI agents on the building next to the Texas Book Depository. And one of the officers asked about Lee Harvey Oswald, and they just kind of laughed it off. He had nothing to do with the assassination. He was just a patsy. And the other two, Corsican Mafia, were on the two different routes from where Kennedy was hit to the hospital. They were partway down that route with a spotter with high-powered binoculars who would advise the shooter, the Corsican Mafia shooter, if they thought President Kennedy would make it.
In other words, they wanted to be awfully sure he was dead.
That's right.
And the CIA knew all about it, and they knew exactly who was there, but because no one has ever told the American people that.
Well, a lot of that will be coming out in a documentary film this fall by Wim Dankbars, put together a man from Holland, with the help of 15 retired FBI agents, myself, Dennis David, and Jimmy Files.
Well, let's tell a little bit about when you were asked to kill Lieutenant Commander Pitzer, who actually had pictures of the autopsy of President Kennedy, and you actually turned down after you had been realized that you were supposed to kill an American Army officer in America because he was part of the enemy. He was going to turn secrets over to the enemy because they feared he'd turn the information over to the American people. But what was that story about?
Well, I got a call from Colonel C.W. Patton, who now lives in Florida. He's retired. I'm not sure that he's still alive. He's kind of old. But he called me up to his office, and I reported to him, and he said, go down into the pine trees down there and meet the company agent is down there, wants to talk to you.
That would be from the CIA, the company.
Right. And so I went down there, another officer went with me, and we stopped about 40 feet from him, and I went forward. And he asked me if I would volunteer to assassinate a man that was about to give secrets to the enemy. And I said, well, sure. Now, I assumed that it would be outside of this country, and I was on orders to Vietnam. And the way that it worked is you'd be on orders to an overseas assignment, you'd go and to that assignment, and then you'd disappear and take care of that mission, and you'd be dropped from the rolls as a deserter during that time. Then when you make it back, you're picked up on the rolls. If you don't make it back, you're dropped as a deserter, and that's all your family ever knows. So I said, certainly I will. And I said, who was it? And he told me it was Lieutenant Commander William Bruce Pitcher. And I said, well, where is he at? And he said, Bethesda Naval Hospital. And I said, oh, no. I said, you guys are supposed to use mafia inside this country. I said, I got a wife and three children right here at Fort Bragg, and if I was to accept this mission, I would have to just disappear right now from here. And my wife wouldn't even know where I was, where when you go overseas, she just assumes you're on a mission overseas. So I refused the mission, and the other Green Beret officer came up, and he was single. And I don't know that he did it, but I do know this, that William Bruce Pitcher was killed a year later, and I assume the time element was to find those photos that he had taken of the Kennedy autopsy, with Dennis David, you've had him on your program, he'll verify that he saw those photos himself standing right next to William Bruce Pitcher. As soon as they found out where they were, they killed him. But the interesting thing is that that day, that other officer disappeared from Fort Bragg. And I think that Ken Heiner has enough information in his book, Without Smoking Gun, that would convince the average person that that's what happened.
Well, anyway, we carry both Colonel Marvin's book, The Expendable Elite, and the book, like Kent Heiner, Without Smoking Gun. We've actually interviewed Kent Heiner. We've interviewed Dennis David. And Davis Dennett was an enlisted man in the Navy. And, of course, certainly Lieutenant Commander Pitzer actually showed him the... were they pictures of the autopsies or x-rays or what?
No, they were pictures of the actual autopsy. He had a remote control camera. And he controlled it from the other side of the wall, the autopsy room.
And, of course, the thing is that they could never let the American people know that it wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald at all. That the bullet had come from the front, the bullet that created the wound in the throat, the bullet that took off the the president's head, and there were a number of bullets that were fired. There weren't just three bullets. But how can you let the American people know, not only that you killed an American president, but that you were able to cover it up with a Warren Commission report and a magic bulletin. And, of course, there are many of the people there, who participated in the charade. People like Gerald Ford. He was rewarded by becoming the President of the United States. Arlen Specter, counsel for the commission, he became Senator Arlen Specter.
Right.
And, of course, there was one congressman who really Hale Boggs, I think was his name, he believed the whole thing was a charade. When his plane went down in Alaska, the FBI knew where the plane was and refused to send help. And, of course, he and everybody on board the plane died. And certainly Senator Richard Russell knew it was a fraud, too. But, of course, that information never came out. So the American people was told, it was unanimous. There were a couple of people there who knew exactly what was going on. But, of course, here you had Alan Dulles, one of the major architects of the whole thing. He was on the Warren Commission. And J. Edgar Hoover hated the Kennedys. He was intimately involved with the whole thing.
Dr. Stan, you probably know more about this than I do, but I understand that once Gerald Ford died, then they have found the notes on a yellow, lined yellow pad, I understand, which is what he used for his notes, in the Warren Commission, ordering that the schematic drawing of the bullet... The magic bullet was changed 3 inches to make sure that it followed what they wanted the public to know.
Well, I've heard that. I don't know it to be a fact, but no. I would... obviously, the magic bullet was totally fraudulent, but the whole story was fraudulent. And if they would lie about that, would they lie about the murder of Martin Luther King? And, of course, some evening we'll have Colonel Marvin back, and we'll tell you that story because he has a great deal of information on it. And then, of course, would they lie about the murder of Bobby Kennedy? Would they lie about what happened at Oklahoma City? Would they lie about what happened on 9-1-1? Would they be able to get away with it? would they use exactly the same sort of a technique of having a government investigation and then sealing all of the important information for 50 years? And what most Americans don't know is that there are 1,200 people who testified before the 9/11 Commission. Most of them testified in secret, and 1,100 testimonies were sealed for 50 years so that Osama bin Laden would never be allowed to know what happened that morning. We're going to be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program. If you'd like to get the entire text, of course, we talked during the breaks, and either the tape or CDs of the program are available by calling us at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Colonel, your website one more time?
ExpendableElite.com.
ExpendableElite.com. You go there. You get the information. You help us get the truth out while there's still time.
Amen.
Well, Colonel, we have 3 minutes to wrap up the program. What's a parting thought and information you'd like to leave with our listeners?
You know, I sent you a copy of an article, Relive the Past to Protect Our Men and Women in the Future, more or less. And what I'd like every person to do that's listening to your program is to understand that we did, in fact, aid the enemy in Vietnam. We did, in fact, aid the enemy, as General Schwarzkopf himself complained that we allowed the enemy the use of the mosques to store weapons and to actually attack his people from. And the way he phrased it was just like we gave the enemy safe havens in Vietnam. We're still doing it. And I've got a grandson over in Iraq right now. He was wounded once, and he's back there now to be with his buddies doing what he feels he's been ordered to do. I've got another grandson who'll be heading back there this spring. And I'd like just for one time to be certain that our leaders are being told how to win the war and being allowed to win the war with our troops.
Well, I think that, of course, there's a new book out called Cheers and Tears, written by a Marine Corps Lieutenant General. And, of course, he tells, you know, about the meeting that was held in November of 1965 when the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff went to Lyndon Johnson to tell him they knew how to win the war. And, of course, Robert McNamara wouldn't let them. And it tells what happened as Lyndon Johnson swore and cursed and flew into a rage. And the title of the chapter is The Day That Vietnam Became the Longest War. Our boys were not allowed to win the war in Vietnam. That is what the one thing that they can't let the American people know. We could have won it at any time. We were never allowed to win. We could have won the war in Afghanistan. We could have won the war in Iraq. And we were never given the forces that were needed to do the job. We're allowing the Shia militias to exist. Shia militias fomenting death squads. We're financing, we're training them. And then they become the enemy. Nothing makes sense unless you understand it's like deja vu all over again. Colonel, thank you so very much for being with us. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. It's been a blessing.
God bless you. We'll be talking to you again real soon. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And, of course, certainly Colonel Marvin is one of my favorite guests, and we have him on not infrequently. He's a very brave and courageous man. He has to be to come forward and risk his life. They've threatened his family. They are government for telling the truth. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I was just commenting that certainly Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin's one of my favorite guests. And they've threatened his grandchildren. They've called his wife to intimidate her and told her, well, your husband may not fear anybody but Jesus Christ, but remember, he's got grandchildren. These are people within the military. Why? Because they can't have the truth come out. There are a lot of wonderful people in the military, but when you're told to do something, you do it, even if it means turning against everything you believe in. That's the way the military works. But unfortunately, when you have evil and wicked people in positions of authority, and you don't have military officers who are willing to resign their commissions and come forward. And I will tell you, we have had a number. We've had at least close to a 10 generals and admirals who've quit their jobs to come forward to tell the American people that we're betraying our boys over in Iraq, and they've been demonized by the media. How dare they come forward? They're undermining the position of our boys. They're undermining our troops. No, they're trying to save their lives, because more and more are going to go over, and more are going to die. 58,000 Americans died in Vietnam because of the Gulf of Tonkin incident that never took place. It turned out it was all a lie. Oh, shucks, imagine that. It was all a lie. Well, we're not being told the truth about 9/11, and we're not being told the truth about what's going on in Iraq today. And you need to help us get out the truth. We hope many of you want to get copies of this tape and so many of the other tapes we have. You need to get our four-tape set on the Military Commission Act. You need to get our four-tape set on what really happened on 9/11. You need to get our four-tape set on why did the buildings come down. You need to get the DVDs we carry on what happened on 9/11. We carry five of them in 9/11 Press for the Truth, 9/11 Mysteries, In Plain Sight, The Day That Changed America Forever, and Terror Storm. They're all available from Radio Liberty individually or together at a very reduced rate. Help us get the truth out. Go up on my website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Pull down my August, September, October, November, and December newsletters. Put them in a binder. Read them through. Read them through again. Read them through again. If you need any of the facts checked out or the references, it's all right there. You need to get our little pamphlets. There are three of them. They're inexpensive. They're called Foreknowledge 9/11, the compilation of my previous letters on 9/11. You need to understand that we have done everything we could to block proper training of the Iraqi army. And you need to get the works of Major General Paul Eaton, who was given the assignment to rebuild the Iraqi army and blocked at every turn. You need to find out that we're betraying our boys. It's deja vu all over again. So the information is there at Radio Liberty, but behind this are powerful spirits and forces. Now remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Your job is to get our information. Certainly read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, to understand the spiritual forces that energizes the people who are betraying America. You see, they have a different worldview. Their dedication is not to America. Their dedication is to the destruction of America and creation of a world government and a new world religion to destroy our currency, to destroy the stability of our nation, to destroy the sovereignty of America. When you understand that, you can understand why we're not blocking our borders, why, of course, everything is done to demoralize the men working on the border today, why, of course, they refuse to, when they get somebody from a terrorist country coming across our border, why they immediately release them. That's known as the catch and release program. These things are happening today, ladies and gentlemen, because we have people who have a different agenda. You need to get the information, the great new book we have, Satanic Crimes, goes into the Bilderbergers and the Bohemian Grove and certainly the Skull and Bone Society. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty. We're on the front lines of this truly spiritual battle for the souls of men. Well, Dr. Stan, back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king, but in a battle for survival of Western civilization. It's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and we do hope that that many of you will check to try to prove us wrong, and if you cannot prove us wrong, that you'll join us in this epic struggle, a struggle for the very souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Well, our guest this evening is Carol Matriciana, and we're going to be talking about some of the videos she's made. We're going to be talking about the spreading of belief in witchcraft and the supernatural among our young, and even increasing belief in the supernatural among many of the adults in this country. And there is a growing fascination with this idea of being able to find the real power, the hidden power that is hidden within each one of us. And it is that old adage that began in the Garden of Eden. When the serpent said to Eve, "And ye shall be as gods." And this has been the message down through the eons, that man has within his own capacity the ability to be as God. And of course, to have these supernatural powers, to be able to contact this other dimension. And of course, on the front line of this is a woman who actually came out of the occult, out of the New Age movement, having been born in India and raised in a British family, during the latter days of the British Empire, and then going to England and becoming involved with the New Age movement, and then becoming a Christian. And Carol's been working very hard for many years to expose this fifth column, this subversive religious fifth column within our society today. Carol, thank you so very much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. It is always such a wonderful privilege to be with you.
Well, tell us what you're seeing today, because things are moving very, very fast as these ideas are being spread in our children and even in our adults.
Oh, it is just incredible how quickly things are moving. You're absolutely right. About 20 years ago, I made a film called Gods of the New Age, and I wrote a book of the same title. And just watching in the past two decades the change of Eastern mysticism, Hinduism, yoga, the way that yoga is now being taught in schools. It is just incredible. I am on the verge of finishing a film on yoga. And in fact, this very week I'm concluding it. And you are going to get one of the first copies, which I am very excited to tell you about. But, you know, just the incredible thing of how yoga has now completely appeared to be, is marketed as though it isn't a Hindu Eastern mystical practice.
But isn't this really very similar to what we're actually taking up in so many of our Christian churches today in the name of contemplative prayer, where you sort of put yourself into this state that you'd have with yoga?
Exactly. You're absolutely right. It's crossed into markets. It's gone across from secular thinking into our Christian institutions and organizations. And in fact, this is what my latest film is about, how it has come into the church, how it is presenting itself in the church, how we are opening ourselves up to this spiritual realm out there without even calling it a spiritual realm in some cases. I mean, it's just amazing. 20 years, 30 years ago, it was so obvious that Eastern mysticism, that yoga came from Hinduism. It was so obvious it came from India. But then it started getting packaged as a scientific program, as though it was somehow scientifically proved that it was able to bring about a fitness. It was able
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, you go right ahead and pick your thought up there, Carol.
I was just mentioning that the way that yoga became repackaged as though they could take away the spiritual aspects of it, as though it could be scientifically monitored somehow, that the sort of spiritual connection that one opened oneself up to could be monitored in a scientific way, and you know, presented as scientifically showing improvement. For instance, just recently, in 2003, I believe it was, there were researchers at California State University that studied these TEP scores at the Accelerated School District, and particularly focused in on this new yoga that is being taught to children in schools, 100 schools across 26 states. They've adopted this GUBA's yoga educational program, and more than 300 physical education instructors have been trained in it. So here we had the researchers of the California State University looking into how the students were performing. And so scientifically, they have found a correlation between the kids that take yoga, that they've got better behavior, better grades, and they said these young kids that have been taking these programs are much more fit than the district average, you know, in the physical fitness thing. So they take these tests. They show that they're scientifically supposedly accelerated and being able to perform better. And they're not seeing that here in schools where they've taken out the Bible, they've taken out prayer, they've taken out Christian foundational anything that is associated with a Christian worldview, and yet they're bringing in Eastern mysticism, completely connected with yoga, Hinduism. All of that is part of this Eastern mystical worldview, and this is now being brought into schools where they say that they can empty, that they can separate the physical from the spiritual. So it's absolutely amazing that this has grown. I mean, at a time when we've got Harry Potter being coming into the schools, where the Bible's being taken out, Harry Potter's been allowed to be read aloud in the classrooms, and here we've got witchcraft brought in a child-friendly way to our young students, teaching them all about this young wizard learning wizardry.
Hold that thought there for just a moment, Carol. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest is Carol Matrician, and we're talking about yoga that is coming into our schools, which is basically a form of Eastern mysticism. Could you explain to our listeners who really don't understand yoga what this is, how it works, and why it is so deadly dangerous?
Well, Dr. Stan, as you said earlier in your program, I was born and raised in India. And I was fifth generation born in India and very, very familiar with Eastern mysticism and Hinduism. And in India, yoga and Hinduism are synonymous. The practice of yoga is something that is done by most Hindus in the last stage of their lives when they're preparing to go into their next into the next phase of life in their reincarnation cycle. So the Indian, excuse me, the Hindu believes that their body goes from body to body so that when they die out of this one body, their soul goes into another body and another body and so on. And depending on what they've accomplished or done in past lives determines how they will come back in future lives. So yoga is a very, very important part of preparing them for death, preparing them for reincarnation, helping them to change their mind through mind exercises, even though they're also physical exercises, but the physical exercises are connected with deities. Every body posture is connected with a deity, the name of an animal that the body gets into in order to be able to become one with the universe, become one with the idea, the Hindu idea of deity, is that all nature is divine, if you will. So the problem with man is he doesn't understand his divinity, and he doesn't understand that he's one with the cosmic consciousness. And so yoga is part of changing his consciousness, changing his mind to become one and become united with the sort of higher consciousness, this divinity, before he gives up this body in order to be prepared to bring his soul into the next body.
Well, Carol, does this state of mind that is being stressed, this almost altered state of consciousness, do you think this opens one up to demonic possession?
It's certainly, if one comes from a biblical worldview, we would understand it, because the Bible explains that we have to love the Lord our God with all our mind. We have to bring our mind under the mind of Christ. We have to have God's opinion. So from a biblical point of view, we're told not to give up our minds, not to put our minds into neutral, so to speak, because it would open up a doorway for our minds to be taken over by another being. Now, within Hinduism, they don't see that. That is not what they would see in a negative way. They believe that every single energy out there, every single sort of force, if you will, is part of divinity. So, yes, from a biblical viewpoint, of course we would say that it's supernaturally dangerous and something that we mustn't get involved in. From an Eastern perspective, they say you must get involved in that in order to understand the energy that you have inside of yourself that has to be awakened. In fact, even more incredible, it's only in the Bible that the serpent is seen as the enemy of God. But in every other culture, the serpent is believed to be a divinity of wisdom, an energy of wisdom, and actually, within yoga practice, this cobra, this serpent, this energy is called Kundalini, and it is believed to lay dormant at the base of each person's spine and must be awakened through yoga. This serpent power is awakened, brought up through the chakras or psychic energies that are believed to be along the spine, and ultimately to come up to the very top psychic energy, which is called the third eye, between the two eyes up in the forehead, and then this will ultimately open the yoga practitioner up through a mind-altering experience to the understanding that they are divine and part of divinity and can be united with cosmic consciousness or the Hindu god, which is an impersonal force. So it is unbelievable that these two completely opposing worldviews are not, it's not called a worldview when this yoga practice is brought into schools and being practiced now in hundreds of schools across America. The young children, the teacher, Gerber, that put this thing together, specifically worked on taking out everything that appeared to be spiritual. She very, very specifically engineered this. She's been a yoga practitioner since for many, many years, and she wanted to bring yoga into public schools, but there was this absolute outcry that it was religious, and so she put together this program to supposedly take out all these sort of Sanskrit, Eastern Hindu concepts, and she called them completely different things. So she called breathing, which is an important part of yoga to stimulate an altered state of consciousness, she started calling it bunny breathing for her little children, and all these different terms. Meditation, she didn't call it meditation, she called it time in. So she changed the names of these practices, stripped every piece of anything that could vaguely be construed as spiritual or Eastern, it would come from its Eastern worldview, its Eastern base, and she was able to bring it into schools. And in fact, the government pays grant money to bring this to bring these teachers. The federal government gives grants to gym teachers who completed a teacher training course in yoga, and so hence we've now got this thing in with kids who wouldn't even be imaginable that they could read the Bible or say Christian prayers or learn anything Christian in schools, and yet they're able to practice Hindu mysticism, Eastern mysticism, in the form of this sort of new type of yoga.
Well, you know, I think one of the hardest things for the average American, even for many American Christians, to recognize is the fact that there is a spiritual dimension behind everything going on today. We live in a materialistic world, but there is a spiritual dimension in which these demonic spirits and these other forces work. And one of the things, of course, that the mystics do, many of them, will actually tap into this other dimension. Now, certainly our students, when they're putting themselves in this altered state of consciousness, do not understand that there is another dimension, and there really are spiritual forces there that would love to claim their soul. Sounds pretty absurd, but would you agree that this is the real danger for the people who put their minds into this altered state of consciousness, that they're opening themselves up to be possessed?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, you know, even the Hindus, even strong Hindus, will absolutely admit that yoga is part of their religion. It's part of the sacred teachings and practices of their religion. And while they wouldn't agree that this is negative, the way that Bible-believing Christians would understand that that there are dangers, the Orthodox Hindu will admit that it is a religious practice. But Dr. Stan, I think the difficulties are that people don't believe that Satan is real. They don't believe that he is a person. Somehow they've relegated Satan to this force, this impersonal force, just the way that they've relegated God to being an impersonal force. So when you don't have a personal attribute given to Satan, then it just sort of becomes this, it's just not even explained in a way. For instance, even in the Harry Potter books, where Harry Potter's got this energy, which is explained as the white side of his enemy, the evil Lord Voldemort, who has the dark side. So once we start calling this force the light side and the dark side and not giving it a personal characteristic, then it all sort of becomes rather nebulous and doesn't appear to be dangerous. But from a biblical viewpoint and a biblical understanding, God thought so seriously about this the personality of these fallen angels. In fact, I think the thing is that many people just don't know enough about angels and the spiritual world. And when I made the movie Supernatural Powers, the battle between good and evil, in fact, I don't know if you know that it got the best documentary for 2006, for last year.
I really didn't, but we do carry the video. In fact, I was noticing we had copies of it the other day. That's
yeah,
the Supernatural.
I was just thrilled when it was given the best documentary of 2006, but in that we explained that God created all the angels, and that the angels had free will to follow God or not, just as man was created in the image and likeness of God and was given free will, and that there were a third of the angels that chose not to follow God. And these are the fallen angels of the demonic spirits that are longing to have a physical body to come into. So they will come and lie and cheat and try and open the minds of whoever will accept them into, whoever's mind will be opened enough so that these beings can work and communicate through a physical body.
Well, you know, the big problem is, Carol, that our ministers are not teaching this. In fact, they haven't been taught it in their school. And many of them don't even believe in hell or the Satan, or the demonic spirits, or the spiritual battle that's taking place. So how can they teach their parishioners? Well, Carol, you go right ahead with the story, and certainly I was just commenting, one of the big problems we have today is that we have so many Christians who are spiritually illiterate. Their mind have been filled with all sorts of things and doctrines, but they don't understand the very foundation of Christendom and the spiritual battle that began in the Garden of Eden and is coming to its culmination today. And so pick the story up from there.
You're absolutely right. And each of my films that I make, I try in a different way to bring out this, the idea of a personal God and a personal enemy, and the incredible fight in our minds. Our minds are the battlefield for the enemy of God. And this latest film that I have just completed, in fact, it's just going through its completion this week. I went to India. It's been about 4 years in the making. I went to India to interview the experts on Hinduism and yoga teachers and asked them if the practice of yoga, the physical practice of yoga, can be separated from the spiritual practice of yoga. And they absolutely say no, that it is just for them. They are offended that the West treats Hinduism rather like a recipe. And they say that Hinduism is not like a recipe ingredient that can be extracted from yoga, that Hinduism and yoga are totally synonymous. And in fact, Hinduism Today, which is a leading Indian publication, admits that Hinduism is the soul of yoga, and it's based on Hindu scriptures and developed by Hindu sages, and that yoga opens up new and more refined states of mind. And to understand them, one needs to believe in and understand the Hindu way of looking at God. And they warn that a Christian trying to adapt these practices of yoga will likely disrupt their own Christian beliefs. So they understand that there are two different worldviews, that they are opposing worldviews, and yet today we find that Christians are taking yoga, trying to take just the physical practice of yoga and use it just for physical fitness, not realizing that yoga is designed to open up the mind, to introduce the deities as they see them. They call them deities, but from a biblical point of view, we would see them as fallen angels and demons that are in rebellion to God, and that they seek to come into the bodies of human beings so that they can use their vocal cords and their hearts and their minds to perpetuate evil behavior that is quite contrary to what God has designed us to do. And
what you're really describing is demonic possession. So many people say, oh, this could never happen. Nobody's ever possessed by a demon. And don't you for 1 minute believe they could not be. Many people are possessed by demons. And if you haven't yet read this wonderful book we carry called Hostage to the Devil by Malachi Martin, let me suggest you read that. This was my first introduction to this concept. And I will tell you, it's one of the most gripping books you will ever read. And once you've read it, you'll be able to understand what Carol's talking about. There really are people who are actively possessed by demonic spirits. And, of course, it has horrible results. Well, this is Dr. Stan and our guest this evening, Carol Matriciana. And we're simply talking about this concept of demonic possession. And of course, with so many of the things that have been introduced into our churches and into our schools and to in every aspect of our society in the name of yoga and meditation and contemplative prayer and walking the labyrinth, and all of these things are opening you up to demonic possession. So pick the story up there, Carol.
Well, I was telling about the adventures of going to India to interview experts on Hinduism. And, of course, we had done this 2 decades ago when we made our movie Gods of the New Age. And we started talking to the practitioners of yoga back then and followed the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh to his community in Oregon, in Antelope, Oregon, and if you remember that footage of hundreds of orange-clad devotees of Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh involved in these different types of meditation, being completely possessed. And when you saw it on camera and the frightening effects of them opening up their minds, going into these trances and actually seeing their bodies contort and move, and as they swirled and rotated and fell on the floor, blood coming out of one of their nostrils, and oh, it was just, and screaming, just that. I remember when we were filming that, being in this huge open sort of building that didn't have sides, had a roof, but the screaming, the pitch of the screaming as these hundreds of people were opening themselves up to being possessed.
That was one of the most gripping pieces of film footage I've ever seen.
It was incredible. And Dr. Stan, you are going to be amazed at some of the footage that is in the film that I'm just in the process of completing called Yoga Uncoiled. And there we go to the practitioners of Hinduism in India, where the Hindu Vishwa Parishad, which is one of the largest missionary organizations in India, admits that Hinduism is giving way to that Christianity has now been taken over by Hinduism, and that their missionaries in the East have become the great missionaries through yoga, that they are sending their teachers to the West to take over through yoga. And it is just amazing seeing hundreds and thousands of these Hindu disciples at the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, the Allahabad Kumbh Mela, and you look at them, and they look very different to people that appear to be spirit-filled in a good and positive way here. I mean, they were naked, covered in ashes, covered in matted, matting their hair, and looking completely, completely demented.
Well, of course, how about a demonic? Would that be a better?
Absolutely. And it's
amazing
when you actually see all this on camera, where people say that no, this can't possibly happen. But you know, I have been in the middle of demon-possessed people, and I know it to be real. I have watched it. In fact, in one of our filming sessions, this fellow came into the tent as we were changing our films, in the camera, and we needed a sort of a place away from the sun so that we could change our equipment. This fellow came in with this deep, dark, haunting, terrified voice, and at swords. Here I was at the end of his sword as he was about to pierce his sword through me, and fortunately, by the power, the almighty power of a much greater God, I was able to calm this demented person to, to leave me alone.
But, now, of course, did you get this on film?
No. We were changing our film in the cameras, so we couldn't take any film as this was taking place. But I'll tell you, it is absolutely sketched so clearly, etched on my mind. The moment that happened was indeed a scary moment for me. But I have been in the middle, because, you know, I've been involved in counseling people that have been in satanic cults and in Hindu cults. And so I have had the opportunity of speaking to people who are demon-possessed, and actually speaking to these voices that come out of them and accuse me, want to kill me.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, I guess this evening is Carol Matriciana, and Carol is simply talking about how she's had the opportunity on many occasions to minister to people who are demonically possessed, who would actually threaten to kill her. And, of course, we have 4 tape sets with other people who are really in these deliverance ministries. People laugh at it. Oh, there's no such thing. Yes, there is today. Unless you understand that there really is another dimension, there really are demonic spirits, there really are people who worship Lucifer, who hate Christianity, and of course they're doing everything they can today to destroy and discredit Christianity right here in America. And of course, when we see the witchcraft being even taught in our schools with the writings of Harry Potter, this is applied witchcraft 101. And yet this is be allowed in our schools. But we would never dare allow mention of the word of the name of Jesus Christ or have a prayer in our schools. Go ahead, Carol.
Yes, it is. It's amazing. And I think one of the insidious things about, when Satanism or the cults are very obvious, people recognize them. But when they're sugar-coated and cleaned up and called scientific or child-friendly, and can come into our schools, it's absolutely awful. I was talking about this huge, great Indian, this Hindu festival called the Kumbh Mela, and how some years ago I was present at that, and it's organized by India's Vishva Hindu Parishad, which is probably the world's largest missionary organization, and the Kumbh Mela that I went to in 1979 in Allahabad, India, there was actually the Second World Congress on Hinduism. There were about probably 60,000 delegates from around the world that were speaking at that. And one of the speakers said that our mission in the West has been crowned with fantastic success. Hinduism is becoming the dominant world religion, and the end of Christianity has come near. And in this film that I'm just finishing, called Yoga Uncoiled, we show how yoga teachers in the West have become the leading missionaries of Hinduism, and there are probably about 70,000 of them in America today in more than 20,000 locations teaching probably an estimated 35 to 40 million fitness fanatics. And
this is Dr. Stan, and Carol is basically saying that they're teaching, there's 70,000 missionaries here from the Hindu countries, and they're teaching 30 to 40 million people in these new programs?
Yes, I mean, 30 to 40 million Americans are taking yoga across this nation. And what they don't understand is the yoga teachers are basically the leading missionaries of Hinduism, because Hinduism and yoga have been repackaged as a fitness exercise. People don't understand that when they go into the gyms, when they go into the YMCAs, when they go into spas or schools and are taking yoga, that they don't understand that they are being indoctrinated into Eastern mysticism, a mind-changing program. It's not physical exercise. If you want to do physical exercise, you do not sit down in a lotus position and have your mind changed. You go out and you sweat out on a soccer field or in a swimming pool or on the tennis courts. And if you want to do physical exercise, then do radical physical exercise. But yoga specifically teaches to have your mind changed. These exercise programs are presented. They offer themselves as stress reduction or burnout reduction or concentration benefit programs. This is not exercise. Yes, there's some stretching involved, and yes, there's a little bit of sort of rolling around, but it's not physical exercise. So what's happening is yoga is basically experiencing a renaissance worldwide. And it's probably about a $27 billion industry. And here this new type of Eastern mysticism is coming into our gyms and health exercises, health clinics, health studios across the nation, offering stress benefits, and it's promoted in hospital programs as an alternative medical therapy. It claims to reduce blood pressure and benefit the heart, and it is a new type of mental conditioning, now once again being made child-friendly, just like witchcraft was made child-friendly and introduced into the school system through Harry Potter books. So today, we have this new type of yoga being made child-friendly in 100 schools across the nation in 26 states. It's being called Gerber's Yoga Ed Program, and children are being taught it, and it is being promoted as bringing in good benefits for young children, that they can, that they have better behavior and better grades if they do this program. And you know, at a time when public schools, there's no religion, that religion should not be taught in schools, and if they've kicked out Christianity, then also the practice of yoga should not be in public schools. So it's just, everything is changing its language, it's changing its presentation, but basically the bottom line is to condition our minds, to get us into a relationship with supernatural beings out there that are changing us and ultimately preparing us for the world leader, the Antichrist, that is going to come in and rule the world. And there's this sort of huge global conditioning process going on where that so many people just don't understand. And it's interesting that it's not only coming in through school programs or fitness programs, or but it's also coming through the church. And it's being called, this sort of new Eastern mysticism is being called contemplative prayer or centering techniques. And what it does is, it gets Christians into a place where they're not meditating on the Bible, they're not meditating on the opinion of God, they're relating to spiritual experiences and feelings and having their mind emptied to be able to bring in these sort of feel-good ideas that certainly are changing the psyche of the practitioners. I mean, I don't doubt for a moment that these young school kids that are being involved, there's this school program that's been going on now for about 6 years, a six-year-old yoga program that is being promoted as helping distracted children to focus. They're saying that if your children have ADD and focusing issues, that this type of yoga is very important to help children focus and improve their behavior. So here, once again, a spiritual exercise is coming into the schools to change our children's spiritual, mental, spiritual being, to make them more docile or more easily pliable to a controlling method that is going to ultimately be able to come in some global capacity to change the minds of people and make them docile and prepare them for becoming world leader. And, you know, interestingly, of course, we see the same ecumenical program coming through Islam. Very long ago, there was the official Iranian radio that started broadcasting these lengthy series on the imminent appearance of their messianic figure, who it was believed would defeat Islam's enemies, and which, of course, are the Christians and the Jews. And here, there was this, the entire world is going to have this Islamic Shiite rule. And the Muslims are waiting for their 12th Imam, or Mahdi, to come in. And this Mahdi will appear suddenly in Mecca. And Interestingly, the Iranian president expects both Jesus and the Mahdi to return and wipe away repression. So we've got the Muslims waiting for the Messiah. We've got Christians waiting for their sort of coming Messiah.
The return of Christ, and of course the Jews are waiting for the Messiah, and the Hindu is waiting for Maitreya. So.
That's exactly it. And so there's this huge conditioning process that's going on, and so many people are just deceived and blind and don't understand that in order for this world being to, this being to come in, there's got to be a conditioning process, and the conditioning process is being done through mind-altering techniques, bringing in spiritual entities into very, very young kids through all sorts of methods and means. And one of them is yoga, which is what my new film is going to be about. And I think you will be absolutely amazed when you look at a Christian yoga teacher that I interviewed in this, who starts talking about she has completely turned around Christian yoga or the practice of Eastern mysticism and calling it Christian yoga. It is the most incredible interview. It'll be an amazing film. I truly believe it's the best documentary that I've had the privilege of making, and I've made about, over 53 documentaries in the last couple of decades, and I think this one is going to be the most powerful.
When are we going to have it available?
Well, I'm going to send you your free complimentary director's copy next week, Dr. Stanley.
Right,
you are going to see it.
Well, we'll look forward to it, and certainly we'll carry that, and we'll do everything we can to help you get this material disseminated across America, because I think you're certainly, we're very fortunate to have you and your talent trying to utilize video to educate the people. But before we go on, I want you to get out your webpage. I want you to get out the information on how people can get your material. We do carry a great deal of Carol's material, and we'll probably be carrying more, but I want you to know how to get in touch with her material and with her webpage. So what can you tell them?
Thank you, Dr. Stan. Well, they can go on to my www.caryl, I spell my name Caryl, TV, like television, .com. And if they'd like to even make pre-orders, pre-sales for the Yoga Uncoiled video, I will be very, very happy to take any pre-sale orders. Or they can phone me at 951-301-1101.
Give that one more time, please.
951-301-1101. A lot of ones and a lot of zeros. 301-1101.
The thing is that the average American finds it so difficult to believe that this could be in our churches, yet it is. It's called the emerging church. And what we want is for Christians to have an experience. Not to study Christianity, the Word of God, no, to experience Christianity. And we're looking for that Christian experience. And, of course, what we're really doing is opening ourselves up to demonic possession. And the same thing, of course, really is true in every aspect of life. It's in our schools. Certainly, it's in our movies. It's everywhere we look. And the target is the mind of the American people. Altering our perception of reality. They're doing a tremendous job about it. And the big problem is it is taking place because Christians do not understand the spiritual warfare that we're engaged in. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, Dr. Stan. I agree with much of what you say, and it's just, I'm amazed that here you are, always working hard, opening up people's minds, and it still amazes me that people are deceived and can't see. You know, it's a spiritual blindness. That's what's so incredible. A spiritual blindness clouds the minds of so many so that they cannot see the biblical reality. And I have seen the reality of demonic beings, spiritual beings. I've grown up in India. and it's very prevalent and it's very accepted. And, you know, one sees it in, I mean, my daily living, my going to school and living in India, one could see spiritual apparitions and signs and wonders in a way, and incredible powers that came with these things when you gave yourself over to them. And here we've got young kids through the Harry Potter series that want to be like their little hero, Harry Potter, and they want to be able to do the things that Harry Potter can do, the magic that Harry can do. And Harry says, just concentrate. Concentrate on what you want, and it'll happen. And here he specifically teaches young children how to be able to train their minds and be able to think in a different way. And Harry, of course, lives in this world of supernaturalism, in the so-called imaginary school of Hogwarts, school of witchcraft and wizardry, where there are ghosts that live with them, and animals and beings that change into from humans to animals and animals to humans. So there is every aspect of the supernatural world is illustrated in a child-friendly way so that children can see the supernatural through the eyes of Harry. But it looks exciting, and it's a power that Harry has and is able to work and overcome difficulties with, and so they want it. So here it is being shown in the books and, of course, in movies, as you mentioned. I made a film called Gods of Entertainment, where we show the occultism that is prevalent through special effects and the incredible ability of the movie world to be able to make fantasy into reality and capture the imaginations of young children through video games, through the internet, through movies. And so their minds are continually being excited and fascinated by the occult world, which is made to look good if they stay within the white realm of it. And of course, it's also meant to look fearful if you go to the dark side. But they're being told that they can control not going into the dark side, whereas in the world of Harry Potter, you know, you can see that there are dangers in that dark side. And J.K. Rowling, the author, says that each book is darker and darker, and she's going to be coming out with book number 7 in July. And, of course, Warner Brothers is coming out with film number 5 based on book number 5 in July. So here we have this barrage of more child-friendly witchcraft. And then you've got the hero of Harry Potter, Daniel Radcliffe, who has been playing the role of Harry Potter, who just in a couple of weeks is going to be on the theater in the West End, on the stage in the West End, appearing nude and naked in an erotic scene with a horse. So here this young 17-year-old boy who millions of children all over the world see as their hero is getting into this sort of perverse child pornography, and kids are just being bombarded sort of desensitization of morality, desensitization of occultism, and not being able to know what is right and what is wrong. It's just, it's a very, very scary world for young children, I think.
Well, I think they've targeted the minds of our children, and they're doing such a good job through the miracle of video and through the miracle of film. And the average parent doesn't have any idea that this is not simply fun and games. They're really gambling with the souls of their children, because that's what this is really all about. And you know, I was just thinking, Carol, looking back 30 years, you know, when I was getting started in my study, I had no idea that there was this other realm out there, that there was another dimension. The idea of the true supernatural was so far from my mind, because after all, I lived in a materialistic world. And it really wasn't until the early 1980s I began to realize that there is this other dimension, there is this other place out there that where so much of this spiritual battle is being fought. And, you know, until people understand that the purpose of witchcraft is to be able to reach the beings from the other dimension, and they really are able to do that. That's the frightening thing. They're in communion with them. They think that their good spirits are going to helping them, but of course they're not good spirits. They will tell you, well, they're white witches and black witches. No, they're all black witches. They're only shades of gray. And of course, they're dabbling with things they have no idea about it, and will very well cost them their eternal souls. We'll be back here in just a moment here with Carol Matriciana, and of course her new film is going to be on yoga. I can hardly wait to see it. Well, Carol, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program for us.
Well, Dr. Stan, I just would encourage all your viewers to keep in touch with everything you do, listen to you regularly, go into your shop, buy your product, and please come and visit my webpage, www.carryltv.com, and learn and become enlightened to discern, learn about the times we live in, discern the times we live in. These are treacherous times, and we need to be completely as wise as serpents and gentle as doves in these days when our minds are being clouded, whether it's through Islam, the invasion of Islam in America, in fact, that's going to be my next film after this one on yoga, but just to be able to see what is taking place and how they are targeting our young children is very scary indeed. And I thank you so much for what you are doing in alerting and waking up the American public to the dangers in all sorts of realms, in the health realm, in the physical realm, in the spiritual realm. I thank you very, very much.
Well, I think we're really very, very privileged to have the opportunity to have a voice in time like this.
Mm-hmm.
And to know that we have people all throughout the world who are listening to our programs. In fact, it's sort of an awesome responsibility. Because, of course, I feel that I have to present, you know, a reflection of what we would hope that a Christian should. And, of course, being a fallible human being, sometimes when we'll have somebody come on, it'll be very rude and do everything you can to get us antagonized and not to respond, you know, as you ordinarily would anticipate. But, of course, to try to make people understand that Christians are different. And, of course, this is not because we're different on our own, but only because of our reliance on our Lord. And hopefully we can have some impact on people, and hopefully some of our listeners will come to know the Lord. That's my hope and purpose, because I'm certainly not here to entertain. I'm here to make people understand we're involved in a spiritual battle,
mm-hmm.
and they certainly better find out which side of that battle they're on, because there's no neutral position there. Would you agree?
Absolutely. And that's the reason I make each of my films, and every one of them I try and take the opportunity of showing the difference between the two sides. The side that that Jesus Christ has come to set us free from sin. He is our Savior. He wants us to have a time with Him in eternity. And then the other side, His rebellious fallen angels that want to dupe us. And
hold that for just 30 seconds here, and I'll let you finish the thought here. Well, Carol was simply talking about this battle that exists, and there really are two sides. There's certainly the sides of Christianity, and then the sides of the demons and the fallen angels, and you're going to have to decide which side you're on, because there is no neutral position here. Why don't you finish your thought there, Carol?
Exactly. There just absolutely isn't. You know, Jesus Christ himself came to set us free from this absolutely awful condition that we are caught in, the condition of sin, and we can either give our lives to Christ, who has set us free from that, or we can attempt to set ourselves free through all sorts of human methods and ideologies and philosophies and mind-bending and mind-twisting remedies, which I'm afraid will absolutely lead nowhere. And I can tell you, because I was involved in the dark side and have certainly seen both sides of the supernatural world, and I thank my Lord Jesus Christ every day for setting me free from the dark side.
God bless you. Good night, Carol. And we'll look forward to having you on again sometime
real
soon.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Good night.
Good night.
All right, fine. Well, certainly Carol Matriciana is one of my favorite guest. We always enjoy having her with us here. And I hope you'll heed what she has to say. She's come from the other side. She realizes this supernatural power is not imaginary, it is real. But you do not want to even think about tapping into it. Oh, you may get a great wealth, you may get great pleasure, you may get all sorts of advantages and recognition. But you'll pay for what you gain here with your eternal soul. So, understand we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men. We do hope that many of you will go to our website, RadioLiberty.com, and we do carry a number of Carol's videos and or DVDs. And we actually in the past have carried some of Carol's books. We'll have to check and see if we still have them. We do have a wonderful book. It's called The Beautiful Side of Evil. It's written by Johanna Michelson, who is a medium, who is actually being trained as a psychic healer until she suddenly found this was all demonic. That's The Beautiful Side of Evil, and then our four tapes set on the supernatural with my interviews with Johanna Michelson. You certainly want to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, which begins to put this into a geopolitical perspective. You'll certainly want to get Malachi Martin's book, Hostage to the Devil, the story of five exorcisms which were certified by the Catholic Church. And I will tell you, when you read that book, you'll never look at the world through the same eyes again. We also recommend that people will get the four tape set we have, The Wisdom of Malachi Martin. You get them together, the book and the four tape set, that certainly reduce consideration. We do hope that, of course, many of you will get the videos we carry. They sold their souls for rock and roll, pointing out how these influences are in the music business. And the music industry. If you've not yet seen the Da Vinci Con put out by our good friend Pastor Joe Schimmel, who put out the DVDs They Sold Their Soul, the Da Vinci Con goes into what Hollywood is doing and the influence of Gnosticism, which is simply a throwback to an ancient heresy that existed in the first century A.D., and of course, that can be traced back to the teachings of the ancient Kabbalah, which can be traced back to the ancient mystery religions. And there is a continuity of evil since the Garden of Eden, and it is coming to its culmination at this very time we live in. We live in one of the most exciting times in all history, but you better understand what's going on and whose side you're on. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com, where you can listen directly or indirectly to our radio programs on the Internet 5 hours a day, 4 hours a day on shortwave, where, of course, you can listen to our programs 9 hours a day on Telstar 5 satellite. We don't expect you to do it. We hope that you're going to tell others about our programs, but listen when you can. Get educated. And, of course, get the material we talk about. Pull down our web, pull down our newsletters, read them, save them, study them, and then pray for America. Pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, because we're on the front lines of this spiritual battle. Till tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.